Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Everybody, not the usual intro for the program this evening. It's about 2 minutes past the hour. I'm Bob, of course, and it is Wednesday, at least here in the this part of the world. And I'm sitting in an empty auditorium, waiting for folks to come here to the Irma Bird Center at houses Concord Beckley University, the Beckley campus of Concord University. For the second night of David K. Johnston's remarks regarding his new book, Free Lunch. That's going to start about 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time, and we're looking forward to it indeed and very much, and so I hope you'll stick around until then. This is also sort of a sound check. And I'm waiting to hear from Agnes or anybody else, for that matter, as to whether this is actually going out into the wide, wide world of the Internet. See, how's this for conversation radio? How's this for real, straight-up, honest radio? You even get to hear the sound checks of which this is one. We pull the curtain back and... you see how it all works, which I think is cool. So I'm hopping into the headonradionetwork.com chat room right now. And we'll see what's happening there. Oh, I hate it when that happens. Okay, let's see if anything's happening. Okay, Agnes tells me it's coming through. That's a bonus. And there we are in the chat room. Oh, hey, Matthew. Hi, Agnes. Hey, Cobwebs. Hey, hello, Frozy, Lottie. Oh, there's Peter Gombold and Powerpuff and Ralphs. So, well, this is almost like Romper Room, isn't it? And I see Powerpuff, and I see Agnes. Next thing you know, we'll be getting out the doobie. Never mind. Those of you of a certain age will appreciate the Romper Room reference, but everybody else, yeah. So, you know, if you're not in the chat room yet, hop on by, jump in. It's free. It's easy. And share the conversation as we listen to David K. Johnston this evening. Yes, I know, Peter. Clowns scare you. They scare me, too. Carnies scare me more, though. All right, Rody Ferg is going to have an aneurysm if I don't let him at least get to say hello. So he's, you got to let the Rodies talk once in a while. Hey, Rody Ferg.
Hey, Bob. I just know you love torturing me now.
You're the one that was having a conniption to get on the air. Don't start with me.
Well, it's good to get on every once in a while.
Yes, indeed. So, Agnes, are y'all getting mic 2 okay as well? That's the main purpose of this. And I guess we'll just sit here and listen to silence for a couple of minutes until I can see some sort of a response. No. Okay, now, let's see. I'm broadcast man and you're production boy. Production boy, take off your cans and go over to the other microphone, please.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're good on mic 2. Let's try mic 3. Stand by. Okay, production boy.
Check 1, check 2.
Okay, you don't have to Freddie Mercury the microphone. Just, you know.
Hey,
this is professional broadcasting, okay? Don't do that.
Check 1, check 2.
Okay, now say sibilance.
Sibilance.
Okay, now put the microphone back.
Yes.
Okay, so everything appears to be... Okay, 3's too hot. Okay, let's pull back 3 a little bit. Well, that's only... yeah. 3 mics, did we get a grant? Oh, I don't have the other 2 hooked up, and I could. I really, really could. But, so, there we go. So we're all set up. Let's see, I'm going to start some music. And I'll just run some music of my own choosing that speaks to my own personal twisted sense of what kind of music ought to be running for the time being. And with that being the case, I'll close the microphone. We will get this thing cranked up at about 7 p.m. Eastern time. I got to do the math again. See, I can't keep it in my head. 4 p.m. Pacific. So stick around till then. Enjoy the tunage. And, again, enjoy the remarks by David K. Johnston. And if you have not purchased or found some way to get into your hands his book, Free Lunch, the full title of which is, he said, noting that he had just put the... Okay. Okay, it's free. See, I thought I had the screen up that had all the data on it. In the first place. Yes, Agnes, was Ferg hot on mic 2 or mic 3? That was when he was yelling and carrying on and so forth. I got that. So I think we'll be A-OK. Just one second here. Just one second. Yeah, there's the whole title. Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. You've known that's going on. You know we're getting ripped off. You know working America is carrying the richest 0.1% of America on its back. You know that the wages that we earn, the wages that we're taxed on, you know that goes to fund the people who think that they've got some sort of divine right of the filthy rich to not have to work for a living. But what you get when you read, and I recommend both books, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, as well as the latest book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. I recommend them both because that's ammunition. And if the pen is mightier than the sword, we live in an age when perhaps the voice is mightier than the pen. As long as we are willing to talk amongst each other and willing to make the debate open up. If we're willing to do that, then David K. Johnston has provided you with the necessary facts, and he's done it in such a way as to make it possible, and not just possible, but make it likely that when you talk about this, you can A, make sense of it to people, and B, that you can be cogent as you discuss these issues. So I'm going to leave the stream go. We'll get some tunes up. You'll be hearing from you'll hear from Dr. Bill O'Brien. A little bit you'll hear from me. I'm going to introduce Mr. Johnston. And then you'll hear from David K. Johnston. All that is only about 50 minutes away or so, and I'm looking forward to this second night of hearing from this brilliant, brilliant man. So we'll have a little... What, Ferg? What am I forgetting you about?
Nothing.
Okay. Yes. And yes. Production boy is here. Rody Ferg is here. But you know that. Okay, so music time. All right? Stand by.
The movie wasn't really doing so hot, said the new producer to the old big shot. It's dying on the edge of the great Midwest. Sabu must tour or forever rest. Hey look, my, here comes the elephant boy, bundled all up in his corduroy, headed down south towards Illinois from the jungles of East St. Paul. His manager sat in the office alone, staring at the numbers on the telephone, wondering how a man could send a child actor to visit in the land of the Windchill Factory. Hey, look, my, here comes the elephant boy, bundled all up in his corduroy, headed down south towards Illinois, from the jungles of East St. Paul. Sabu was sad, the whole tour stunk. The airlines lost the elephant's trunk. The roadie got the rabies and the scabies and the flu. They was low on morale, but they was high. Hey, look, my, here comes the elephant boy, bundled all up in his cooler road, headed down south towards Illinois, from the jungles of East St. Paul, from the jungles of East St. Paul, from the jungles of East St. Paul. I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the gun to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And there are lies in the balance.
There was a ruby that she wore on a chain around.
the shape of a heart. In the shape of a heart. Was a time I won't forget. For the sorrow and regret. And the shape of a heart. And the shape of a heart. I guess I never knew she was talking about. I guess I never knew she was living without. People speak of love, don't know what they're thinking of. Wait around for the one who fits this type of love. Speak in terms of belief and belonging. Try to fit something into belonging. Some ancient fight about the size of a fist. Something thrown that had missed. There were other holes as well in the house where our knights fell. Far too many to repair in the time that we were there. People speak of love, don't know what they're doing. Reach out to each other through the push and shove. Speak in terms of the light and the learning. Try to think of a word for the burning. Keep it up. Try so hard. Keep the life from coming apart. Never know what reaches and faults are concealed in the shape of a heart. In the shape of a heart. In the shape of a heart. Was the ruby that she wore on a stand beside the bed in the hour before dawn, when I knew she was gone, and I held it in my hand for a little while, dropped it into the wall, and let it go and let it fall. I guess I never knew what she was talking about.
judge my world at night. To a place in the past, we've been passed out of. We'll be right back.
It ought to be in the yard, it ought to be parts. When you get into it, it never starts. It's too ugly, no need to clean. Burns more oil than gasoline. It ain't nothing but a money hole. Bad habit, you need to unload. Get that thing off of the road. I can see you think duct tape is chrome. The car crusher should be its new home. You pass the point of buyer's remorse. Better off just to ride a horse. It ain't nothing but a money hole. Bad habit, you need to unload. Get that thing off of the road. Now. Tailpipes dragging in the dirt. The tires are bald, somebody's gonna get hurt. There's smoke coming out of the carburetor. Built with pride, overseas by convict labor. It ain't nothing but a money hole. Bad habit, you need to unload. Get that thing off of the road. It ain't nothing but a money hole. Bad habit, you need to unload. Get that thing off of the
I'm trying to be less polite. I'm saying what I really think. The president's a fool. I don't want to get up early, and I wish I had a good stiff drink. I'm trying to be less polite. I want to call a spade. I want to stop the war, because I know the war will send too many children to an early grave. Wrong. Let the people marry, tell me why are you so worried. Let me sing it to you in this song. I'm trying to be less polite. I'm gonna tell you what I've seen. Worthless information, is it corporate creation? Yeah, they're trying to kill democracy.
somebody was looking for some easy money.
All right. I think we're getting pretty well close to starting time. So I've killed the music. And what we will do is, you may hear a little bit of silence here for a little bit. Then the presentation will begin. Like I said, you'll hear from Dr. Bill O'Brien. You will hear from me. And then you will hear from David K. Johnston. And a note about Dr. Bill O'Brien. If you're listening to the weekend stream on the Horn, the Head-On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice, you want to make sure that you listen in for Dr. Bill O'Brien's new program, Counterpoint, in which he's offers up brief commentaries on subjects that just sort of grab him and that he thinks will grab you too. And that runs in the weekend rotation, usually right after the Rick Smith show on Saturday and Sunday evenings. So usually somewhere around 6:30, 6:45, along in there. I think you'll really enjoy it. So we'll go dark now for a little bit, and then we'll light this candle. How's that sound? You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Good friend of mine who will be, I don't need this thing. I'm going to introduce Bob Kincaid, a good friend of mine, who will introduce our speaker. I might tell you that Bob is going to be broadcasting this presentation this evening live over the Internet. So everybody in the world will have the opportunity to hear tonight's program. And with time, more and more people will be listening to programs like this. I want to welcome you to this building. If you haven't been here, I encourage you afterwards to take a chance and walk around the building and just look at it. We love it here. We will have coffee, bottled water. There are copies of our speaker's books out there if you'd like to perhaps purchase one afterwards. I'm sure the speaker would be glad to autograph it for you. We'd like to give you an opportunity to interact with him after tonight's program. So I'm going to begin by introducing the person who will introduce our speaker for this evening, and I'd like you to meet Bob Kincaid.
I'm not the guy to be clapping for. You'll be hearing from him in just a second. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. David K. Johnston is the kind of journalist that I hold the highest regard for, because he became a journalist by becoming a journalist. In other words, at 19 years old, in the late 60s, he talked his way into the San Jose Mercury News and then proceeded to learn the journalism craft and then educated himself around it. That takes a lot of nerve, and I admire it. He took what became a calling for him and went through, as I said, the San Jose paper, the Detroit Free Press, and eventually talked the New York Times into trying a new way of reporting on tax issues, something that would be an independent approach to taxation that wasn't all wonkish and policy-based or you know, the stuff that we get out of Washington, but rather would be based upon his investigations. And out of that came a very successful run at the New York Times, including a Pulitzer Prize. I would hazard to say that this is the first time in a long time that Beckley, West Virginia, has hosted a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I would also hazard a guess that this is the first time that a Pulitzer Prize winner has set foot inside this magnificent new facility, the Irma Bird Center. What we're talking about this evening is one book in particular, and that is Mr. Johnston's most recent release, Free Lunch. It's available for sale out front. I encourage you to get it. I also encourage you to own Perfectly Legal, the book that came before it. Both of the what these are a call to, they're calls to action. They are factual ammunition that you can use in understanding what is being done to the American people in what is conceivably or conceived as a legal fashion, but is in fact, well, free lunch, isn't it, David? So please avail yourself of the opportunity to purchase these in the atrium. If you're listening online, you can go to the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com store and purchase them there as well. So with all of that in mind, I hope you will enjoy David's remarks as much as I did last night and expect to again. And so without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, David K. Johnston.
Well, first of all, to those of you who are waiting, I apologize for being late. That's my fault, and not polite, and I apologize about that. Can you hear me all right in the back of the room? Okay, good. They need this not because I can't talk. I can talk just fine without it, but they need it for the Internet streaming. Free lunch is about two fundamental things. It is about how billions and billions of the tax dollars that Americans pay never get to the government. They instead are diverted into the pockets of the Waltons, the richest family in America, Warren Buffett, the richest individual in America, Donald Trump, George Steinbrenner, and a lot of other people that I name in my book. It is also about competitive markets. Now, you know, you don't hear politicians use that phrase. They always talk about free markets. There's no such thing as a free market. All markets have rules. And in a competitive market, the kind of market that Adam Smith, the man who basically explained capitalism to us in 1776 in a book called The Wealth of Nations, that is still in print today, 232 years later. Competitive markets are ones that result in the lowest possible price to the buyers and the greatest possible variety of products and services being available. And what's been going on through our government is the thwarting of those markets, the reduction of competition, and most importantly, government putting its thumb on the scale on behalf of the people who are the sellers in those markets from whom you buy. Now, I got into all of this because for years I did general investigative reporting. I once hunted down a murderer the police failed to catch in Los Angeles and got a young man who'd been sentenced to life in prison freed from prison by hunting down the real killer. I am the person who changed the reputation of the Los Angeles Police Department from what back in the 60s, 70s, and 50s was the most honest, effective dragnet Jack Webb police department in the world to what people know it is today, operating under the aegis of a federal judge, a police department that had gang members in uniform. I'm the guy who wrote the story that prompted Jack Welch, the CEO of General Electric, to give up his free Boeing 737 corporate jet and all his other retirement perks after explaining the economics of it. And I wrote a number of stories in the New York Times, including ones that prompted President Bush and Congress to pass 5 new laws after I revealed such things as the fact that Enron did not pay taxes and that American companies were renting mailboxes in Bermuda so that they could earn profits in the United States but pay no taxes. Free lunch looks at the other side of the equation, not the tax system and the flow of money to the government or lack of flow, but rather the outflow of money from the government or the diversion of money from the government. So one side is sort of the revenue statement. This is the expenditure statement. Today, if you walk into any of the new big box retailers, Walmart, Lowe's, Home Depot, Target, or if you walk into Cabela's or a Bass Pro, the sales tax you are required to pay at the cash register may very well not go to the government. Not every store has this deal, but many of them do. And the deal is this. They have something called tax increment financing, or TIF. You'll read this if you pay attention to it now in the newspapers all the time. You'll hear it on the radio or the TV. Tax increment financing. What does that mean? I mean, any of you have a clue? Anybody want to raise your hand? Do you have a clue what it means? One person who's heard me talk before. What it means is this. The sales tax that you pay at the cash register doesn't go to the government. It's instead kept by the owners of the store, and it is used by them to pay the costs of acquiring the land and building the store. Now, it's not as simple as they just reach into the cash register and take the money. In fact, it's much more subtle, and a lot of people get a little piece of the money along the way. And when these deals are done, typically, by the way, the store is also exempt from paying property taxes for a period of 7 to 10 years, as long as it takes to pay for the store. What happens is these big national retailers come to the local city council or the county or whatever the appropriate agency is and say, we want to create jobs. And we're going to build a big new store, and we're going to employ 60 people, 200 people, 700 people, whatever it is. If it's an entire shopping mall, it may be more than 1,000 jobs. And all we need to do is this. There's this piece of land out by the freeway where the interchange is, where people would want to come. Well, we want you, the government, to go and condemn that land and use the government's power of eminent domain to seize it on our behalf. They could, of course, just go into the marketplace and bid the market price for it. But why do that if the government will buy it for you at a discount? Then we want you to sell bonds, bonds that will pay tax-free interest, that will be purchased primarily by the wealthiest Americans, and use the money from those bonds to rework the ground, build the building, put the fixtures in, put the lights in, everything but the goods we're going to sell, pave the parking lot. And then we're going to lease the building from you under an arrangement where the sales taxes will pay the costs of all of this building and construction and purchase of the land. And when that's all paid off, it's our property. That is, we'd like you taxpayers to buy us a building. This is going on all across America. Now, tax increment financing. The argument is, well, this is increased taxes, so there's no harm being done. It's only additional taxes they're collecting. And here's the fallacy in that argument. Unless there is a growth in the number of people in an area, or their incomes, their real incomes that they can spend rise, then when you open a new store, there is no increment in sales tax revenue. All that happens is people shop now at the location that gets the subsidy, and they don't shop at the locally owned merchants. And one of the stories I tell in Free Lunch is about a man named Jim Weeknecht. Jim Weeknecht lives in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. He owned a little sporting goods store for 20 years. He made enough money that his wife Julie could stay home and raise their 3 kids. And to Jim Weeknecht, that was all he wanted. He wasn't trying to become a gazillionaire. He just wanted to have his nice business. One day, he picks up the local paper in this little town of 4,100 people, Hamburg, Pennsylvania, and reads that the city council has voted to bring Cabela's to town. Cabela's is going to build the world's largest outdoor store, and they're going to sell guns and bows and arrows and fishing equipment, the very same stuff that he sells. And the subsidy they're going to give them is $32 million. I'll give you an idea of does $32 million actually mean anything to you? Can you imagine $32 million? Well, here's what $32 million is. For the same money, the city fathers of Hamburg, Pennsylvania, could have bought every single family in Hamburg a brand new Honda Accord, the top of the line model with leather seats and a fancy sound system and air conditioning. That's what they could have done with that money. Well, Weakneck thinks to himself, this is craziness. And by the way, maybe the city council should give me $1 million, because for $1 million, I could build a really terrific store. And he thinks, no, first of all, that's crazy. If I went and asked them for the money, they wouldn't give it to me. And secondly, it's wrong. The market should decide who's going to succeed in business, not the city council of Hamburg or the city council of Beckley or the governor's office in Sacramento. The market should decide these things. Well, Cabela's comes to town, and very quickly, Jim Weakneck's business collapses. His very best customers all go away. Despite this interesting little fact, Jim Weakneck was prospering in business because when someone would look at a hunting bow or they'd look at a new fly rod and they'd say, I don't know about the price of this thing, he'd say, well, come up here to the cash register. He'd say, let me show you Cabela's catalog. You know, Cabela sells this very same hunting bow, and I've got it, and my price is cheaper. And if you buy it from them, you're going to have to pay shipping, too. And that's how he made his money. He was cheaper than Cabela's. So government not only destroyed his business, government not only gave all this money to the Cabela's, but it created a situation in which people are paying higher prices, which is one of the fundamental strategies that I write about in Free Lunch, how the government is working with business to raise prices. Now, I rely a lot on Adam Smith in my book and the Bible and Andrew Mellon as moral authorities. Adam Smith, most of you probably know Adam Smith because of the story of pins. Up until the 1700s, only the very wealthy had pins. Pins were made one at a time by individuals. You'd finish making your pin, and then you'd start another pin. And then when mass manufacturers began, what we call factories, it dawned on somebody that the smart way to make pins is to break the job into pieces. One person draws the wire, another person cuts the wire, another person fashions the head of the pin, another person heats the end of it and squishes it down. And as soon as somebody figured that out, the price of pins became so cheap that even back then, in the 1700s, people treated pins like we do now. The only reason you pick it up off the floor is because you don't want to get pricked in your foot. You don't care the pin is so cheap if you throw it away or it falls between the floorboards. Well, Adam Smith figured out that the reason people were getting better off was the market. It is the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker, each one doing the best he can with his God-given talents and the amount of capital he has for his business, putting those resources to work, trying to better himself, and having to compete against other butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers, against consumers who can walk along and go, that meat doesn't smell so good, I'm going to buy this guy's meat, that made the market more efficient and tended to hold down prices. Indeed, he said that businesses should only earn just enough profit to justify staying in business. Think about that the next time you hear on the radio or see on the TV or pick up the newspaper and read about a company that says their profits are 15% of their sales, 20% of their sales, that their return on their equity, the amount the shareholders have invested, is 10 or 15 or 20%. Those incredibly fat margins. The competitive market cannot produce those margins. And I tell you this not just as a journalist and an investigative reporter and someone who's studied economics all my life. I'm also the chairman of the board of a little company, and we compete in the marketplace. I have very practical, real experience with this. Now, Smith said, famously, seldom do members of the same occupation gather together, even for merriment. But the conversation turns to a conspiracy against the public to raise prices. We call that price fixing. We had a big trial about that in the 1950s. General Electric and a bunch of other appliance makers were all accused of getting together and agreeing to charge certain prices for their appliances to keep the prices high. That's a crime. Well, Smith went on to say something else that's not quoted nearly as often. And I'm going to do it in two parts. The first thing he said was, by no measure of liberty or justice may government prevent such voluntary meetings. And he's exactly right about that. It's not the government's business to say, oh, you're in the dress business, and you're in the dress business, and you're in the dress business. You can't go out and have drinks together tonight. Absolutely not. That's not the government's role. But then he said something he's rarely quoted about. But government ought not to facilitate such gatherings either. Well, if you watch C-SPAN, notice how often what happens when they turn their cameras on at the meeting of the National Association of Manufacturers, or the pharmaceutical industry, or the Farm Bureau, or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Who is on the dais giving the keynote address? Well, it may be the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, United States Senator, a Congressman, a Cabinet Secretary. It's government officials. Government facilitates these meetings. Government actually spends money at these meetings, your money. Sends people to these meetings. It facilitates them. Now, government has been used intensively since 1980 in particular to drive up prices in this country. Half the states in the United States have gone and changed the way they price electricity. You know, there's nothing Americans love more, I think, than electricity. They love it more than money. They love it more than sex. They love it more than vacations. Everywhere we go, we want to use electricity. It's all over our lives. Air conditioning, iPods, your automobile, lights at night. Electricity, electricity, electricity. If you go to Pompeii, you know, where the where Vesuvius, the volcano, went off about 2,000 years ago, one of the things you're struck by walking down the streets is they're just like us. They have bars and hair salons and laundries, and they all look just like today with two differences. Because they didn't have internal combustion engines. The streets are all very narrow. In fact, the streets are the width of a shopping mall. And secondly, they didn't have electricity. Otherwise, they're just like us. Well, in half the states, it was decided by the state legislatures about a decade ago that they were going to stop our historic system of regulating electric utilities as legal monopolies. And instead, they would break the business in two. Historically, you had one company. They manufactured the electricity at a generating station. They moved it on a power line. They put it on a neighborhood power line, and they delivered it to your home or business. And we consider that a natural monopoly because nobody wants to live in a neighborhood with 18 different electric lines running down the street. And the idea arose that, well, okay, so the distribution of electricity to your home or business is a natural monopoly, but generating the power isn't. So let's instead go to a system of competitive generation of electricity. Well, a lot of these big electric companies then, the utilities, were allowed to do the following. They created a new unregulated sister company. So regulated company over here, unregulated company over here. They then transferred the power plants from this company to this company. And they said, oh, in a competitive market, our generating plants will be worth less money. So the customers should be forced to pay us billions and billions of dollars for these power plants. In one case, in Texas, the most extreme of the cases, but one that was very revealing, a bunch of power plants were transferred, and they were sold for $900 million. And 18 months later, they were sold for a profit of $6 billion. The same power plants, they were 18 months older. That means they were more worn out. But their price went up with a profit of $5 billion. They were sold for $6. They had been bought for $900 million. And the ratepayers had to pay the $900 million because it was argued that they had this value. They had, in fact, already paid for the power plants, the ratepayers, the customers. Well, then they created an electric trading market. We're going to have a market. We're going to everyday trade electricity. And utilities will figure out how much electricity we need. And they know, by the way, about how much power they need every day, every hour. They pay attention to the weather. They know if there's a holiday. They know other conditions in town, and they can accurately predict today how much power they need tomorrow at 7:45 in the evening. And so they created these electricity markets. And everybody said, well, the price of power will fall. Then Governor George Bush of Texas signed the law, said this will mean cheaper electricity for everyone. Well, you all know what happened in California and the Pacific Northwest back in 2000, right? It turns out that these markets, the rules of these markets, were all designed by one company, Enron. Now, Enron is gone. Enron went bankrupt. But half the states still have electricity markets that operate under the Enron rules. So in Texas, this year, in fact, in I believe it was March, electricity that generators were willing to give away, because if you own a nuclear power plant, you got to run it flat out 24 hours a day. So when 2 o'clock in the morning in March, when the weather's temperate, there's no demand for electricity, and you got to get it out of your building, you give it away. You might charge a dollar for a megawatt. People paid over $4,000 a megawatt. In Free Lunch, I tell about an earlier episode where people paid $990 a megawatt for power that the average price offered was, I think, $73, and a great deal of it was offered at $0 or $1 or $2. Why? Because there is no free market. Remember, I started off talking about free markets. Everything has rules. Think about baseball. Now, baseball's fun, but it's ultimately frivolous. It doesn't matter. Baseball has so many rules that they regulate how many stitches are on the baseball. You can't just play with any ball. You have to play with a regulation ball, and it has to be this size, this color, this weight, and the rules say how many stitches are on that baseball. Well, markets have rules. So these markets were tested. At George Mason University, that's a libertarian school, the economics department, tested the Enron markets. They brought in students, other professors. They brought in members of Congress. They brought in journalists. They brought in people they grabbed off the street. They sat them down at computers and said, we will have a simulated electric market here. We want you to trade electricity. You're going to be buyers. You're going to be sellers. And what they discovered was that prices didn't go down in these markets. They rose. Cornell University, they did a similar experiment. A lot of people dismissed the experiment, saying, well, you know, we don't really know that's how real traders would work. The real traders are smart. They drive down the prices. So a professor at Carnegie Mellon University just decided to test this, and he created what everyone who looked at it agreed is an absolutely ideal, perfect market. And he started trading. And within 24 rounds of trading, prices were reaching the levels that economic theory says an unregulated monopoly would charge. Prices within 100 rounds of bidding were at 90% of unregulated monopoly charges. He scratched his head. His name is Suresh Talukdar, and he said, well, something's wrong with my design. And he went back and tweaked his market design a little. He did it again, and the same thing happened, only in this case it only went to 70% of monopoly prices. He did it 2 more times, and again he got near monopoly prices. Well, the first reaction of people who heard about this experiment was, well, the flaw in your experiment has to be collusion. Somehow the sellers of electricity are getting together and fixing the price of electricity. Any lawyer who studied antitrust, any economist who studied that, that's exactly what they would think. That's what my experience from when I went to the University of Chicago Graduate School of Economics tells me. The problem is that it wasn't possible in Dr. Talukdar's experiment, because Dr. Talukdar is not an economist. He's a computer scientist, and his trades were done by software. They were done by software programs so easy and simple that there are high school kids who could replicate them. What he proved beyond a doubt is that the Enron-designed markets that half of America now relies on are designed to produce higher prices. And the evidence from actual trading shows that in those states that adopted these markets, the price of electricity is rising higher and faster than in those states that stuck with traditional regulation of electric utilities. So a complaint was filed with the federal government agency that oversees this. And it was an extraordinary complaint, because among the people joining the complaint were Public Citizen. That's the organization that Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, started many years ago. And also on the complaint was General Motors. Anybody here remember, old enough to remember, what made Ralph Nader famous? He exposed the unsafe conditions of the Corvair in a book called Unsafe at Any Speed, and General Motors put private detectives on him. They went through his garbage. They sent hookers to try and entice him into situations so they could photograph him. Led to a big scandal. They have been mortal enemies for more than 40 years. And on this issue, they got married. And what, by the way, was the response of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, whose members were appointed by a guy named George Bush, who, when he was governor of Texas, signed the law promising electricity prices would fall. Texas now has what are generally the highest electric prices in America. Well, the commission said the following. Once we declare a market to exist, whatever prices that market produces are fair and just and the reasonable and reasonable. And the law says the standard we have to meet is that prices are fair, just, and reasonable. It's a completely circular argument. Now, earlier I talked a little bit about eminent domain and its uses and abuses. So I want to tell you about a woman named Kim Blankenship. Kim Blankenship lives in Toledo, Ohio. In her 20s, she was a welder. She married a guy named Herman. Herman's a mechanic. And Kim, because of family reasons, happened to own a little piece of land right by the factory where Jeeps are built in Toledo. And they got to talking about it. They had two little boys. And Kim said, why are we working for other people? You know, we're going to pursue the American dream. We're going to start our own business. So they opened a garage. And they were very successful because word got around that they did honest work and charged fair prices. And people at the factory, would they drop their car off and they'd say, I need a water pump or I don't know what's wrong with my car. And they'd come back at the end of the day and pick them up. And pretty soon they had seven people on their payroll besides the two of them. And they're making a decent living. Their kids are growing up. And then one day the city of Toledo announces that the Chrysler Corporation wants to rebuild that factory. It's the oldest automobile factory in the United States. It has like 91 buildings and leaky roofs, and some of the buildings date back 100 years. So is Chrysler going to invest all the money needed for a new factory? No. The taxpayers are going to build it for them. Taxpayers are going to pay for it. Oh, and the new factory needs more land. So the city tells people they're going to take all these houses and businesses in the area where the Blankenships are. And the first thing they do is they go to a group of people who are immigrants and whose relatives come from Poland and who can remember when they were young, and they're now mostly in their 60s and 70s and 80s, their grandparents telling them stories about the government saying, move or we'll just bring in the army. And so they get offered a fraction of the real value of their land, and they take it and they leave. And as soon as half the buildings have agreed to be sold and are empty, the government goes to the other building and says, oh, you know, there's this interesting law in Ohio. When a neighborhood is half empty, it's blighted. And that means the property's worth less. So we're now going to offer you a new price for the property that you wouldn't sell to us a little while ago, and it's a lot less than what you got. Well, Kim Blankenship is furious about this, and she recognizes something crucial to what's happening. Not only are they going to take my property and not pay me what it's worth, but more importantly, they're forcing me to pay taxes to subsidize this giant corporation, Chrysler. And if they can force me to pay taxes to Chrysler, they can force me to pay taxes to Bill's Garage down the street, my competitor. And so she gets together with some other people and a professor from Northeastern University, a law professor, he's not a litigator, who is troubled about this, and they go to court. They initially lose their case. They then win on appeal. They get to the United States Supreme Court. What is the position of Chrysler, the state of Ohio, the city of Toledo, and 34 state governments, the city of New York, and some other intervening parties? Kim Blankenship, you have no right to be in court. You do not have what the courts call standing. You have not been harmed in any way the law recognizes. The law has the right, if you're paid for your land, to take it. And you, being a taxpayer, gives you no basis to make a complaint. And that's true. And the reason for that is, of course, if any taxpayer can file a complaint, there's plenty of cranks out there who would clog up the courts with cases. Now, the courts could have a rule that says it's at the judge's discretion, and the judge can take the cranks and throw them out and keep the real cases, but that's not what happened. They get to the United States Supreme Court. There's a whole argument about an issue called the dormant commerce clause of the Constitution, that one state can't set up rules to harm other businesses from trying in other states from doing business in their state. And that's what they want to argue, that this is a violation of the Constitution. And what does the Supreme Court say? The new Chief Justice, John Glover Roberts? I don't see any issue here. Ms. Blankenship has no standing. She has no right to complain. The Bush administration's Solicitor General, who represents the government in Supreme Court cases, tells the court, Your Honors, we don't think you simply should dismiss this case. You should issue an order that she can't even go back to Ohio State Court because she should not be heard. Now, litigation is a terrible way to resolve social problems. Legislatures should resolve these problems. But if you can get laws passed that say, I can tax you and you and you to finance someone's business, and you and you and you have no right to complain, how is that any different than tyranny? What is that? It's corporate socialism. That's what it is. It is corporate socialism. We started this country on a very interesting premise. And the premise was that we did not need King George in England to tell us what to do. We would solve our own problems. Now, every American school child is taught about the Boston Tea Party. You remember hearing about this in school, all of you? And what are we told? We're told two things. It's about taxation without representation, and that it was a protest against high taxes. You know, the Boston Tea Party was not a protest against high taxes. It was a protest against a tax favor for the politically connected friends of King George. The crown, back in those days, gave what were called royal charters, and they created a monopoly. The biggest corporation in the world at the time, the East India Company, and it had the exclusive right to get tea in India and to sell it in England. Well, in November of 1773, four out of every five cups of tea drunk in Boston were Dutch tea. And there was a vibrant competitive market in tea. Every little retail merchant in Boston sold tea. The British East India Company, a monopoly, an unregulated monopoly, a badly managed monopoly, managed to come to have 7 million tons. I think that's the right amount. Maybe it was $7 million. Millions of tons of tea they couldn't sell because the prices were so high in England, and they couldn't sell it in other countries because their prices were too high. So they were facing bankruptcy. In those days, bankruptcy meant you went to jail, or gaol, as it was called in those days. In fact, in the early days of this republic, a sitting United States Supreme Court justice was jailed while he was in bankruptcy, continued to serve on the court. Can you imagine that today? Well, they got Parliament to pass a law that said you will be excused from paying a tax on the tea if you sell it in the colonies, and no one in the colonies may drink any tea except your tea. And what everybody recognized was this was an attack on competition. This was a destruction of the competitive market. It was going to ruin all sorts of little businesses. And that's the reason that they threw all that tea into the harbor, because it was a protest against a tax favor for the politically connected friends of the head of the government. Gee, I think I've been talking about that for quite a while, haven't I? Favors for the politically connected friends of the government. Taxing you or driving up your prices to take care of those people who are politically connected. Now, I'm going to borrow my book from you if I can. I've been speaking at groups all across America for some time about the issues that are in free lunch. And one of the questions I've asked, particularly of students, and I've talked at community colleges and state colleges and fancy places like Yale, why did we create the United States of America? What is the reason that we created this country? I get lots of interesting answers. You know, some people say, well, because we don't want to be colonies, or we don't want to have taxation without representation. But the most common answer I get, the one that a mathematician would call the mode answer, is, well, so we can get rich. That's why I created America, to get rich. Now, those of you with gray hair, some of you are chuckling at this. It shouldn't surprise, it's surprising to us. But if you're young, if you're under the age of say, 45 or 50, that shouldn't surprise you one bit, because what have you heard your entire life since 1980 from presidents of the United States? What have you heard from politicians? All they talk about is how government's going to cut taxes or create jobs so that you can be rich. Well, the reason we created this country has been written down for us. It's 52 words long, and I'm going to reduce it to 6. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. There are 6 concepts there: society, justice, peace, security, commonwealth, freedom. You know what doesn't make that list? Getting rich. Now, I don't have any antipathy to rich. A lot of people afterward, these talks sometimes say, what do you have against rich people? Why do you hate rich people? I don't have anything against rich people. I grew up in pretty bad circumstances. I had to go to work when I was 10 years old. I've worked full-time since I was 13. And compared to what I ever expected in my life, I'm a rich man. I still have to put my pants on every morning and go to work, but I don't have to worry about anything for the rest of my life. It's not about any opposition to riches. It's about what's the purpose of the government. And we didn't create the government to make people rich. And we certainly didn't create it so that a handful of people who are politically connected can get rich by taking money from you. Warren Buffett, the richest man in America, I mentioned him early on. In Buffalo, New York, he built a call center for Geico, you know, the insurance company that has the cavemen and the lizard. It cost $40 million. The taxpayers gave him $100 million. Now, I don't know why the taxpayers should give him a penny, but basically we bought him this facility and gave him $60 million for his trouble. The Washington Nationals baseball team was bought by some investors called the Lerner Group. They paid $450 million for the team. The public subsidy is over $1 billion. So what did we do? We taxpayers bought them the team and gave them $500 million for doing the courtesy for us of buying it. The Walton family, the richest family in America, they seek these subsidies I talked about, the TIF financing. The sales tax goes to them, not to the government, for about a third of their stores and virtually all of their distribution centers. The Cabela family in Sydney, Nebraska. Everywhere in retail stores outside of Nebraska, they seek subsidy deals. In the first 3 years that Cabela's was a publicly traded company, you could buy their stock. For every dollar of profit that they reported, they made subsidy deals worth at least $1.37. Their competitor, Bass Pro, which is privately held and is in the same game, not competing in the market by selling fishing tackle, but reeling in taxpayer dollars. They want to build a store in Buffalo, New York. The proposed subsidy for that store, because I have the deal sheet for it, usually these deals are kept secret, the terms of them, or limited disclosure of them, because, well, this is proprietary business information. It's confidential. It's your tax dollars, but it's proprietary business information, and we can't tell you how we're spending your tax dollars. They're going to build a store there, and the only issue among people in Buffalo who've looked at it and gotten a hold of this deal sheet is whether, because some items have specific dollar values and some of them you have to guess at their value, is whether the subsidy is $90 million or $130 million. $130 million for a store that sells rifles, fishing tackle, hunting gear, This is insanity. There's no other way to describe it. This is economic insanity. This isn't about educating children, buying textbooks, providing health care, fixing the highway so that we can move goods efficiently back and forth. This isn't about having a court system so that if somebody tries to steal your property, you can have it protected, or steal your pension. This is for a fish and bait store. $90 to $130 million. And by the way, there's one company in America that fights these subsidies. It is the competitor of Cabela's and Bass Pro. It's called Gander Mountain. And they actually spend money, and they go to city governments, and they say, as they did in Greenwood, Indiana, where a subsidy of, I think it was $18 million, was proposed for one of their competitors, I forget if it's Bass Pro or Cabela's, to build a store literally across the street from theirs. And they said, wait a minute, we built a store here. We spent our own money. We're selling all of these goods. Why would you give this company $18 million to build a store right across the street from us? And the city fathers say, well, you know, we really don't want to do that. But if we don't give them the money, they're going to go to the next town 10 miles down the highway, and they're going to build the store. Well, let them. Let them. They're not going to create any jobs at that store. They can't. Unless there's a big growth in income or a big growth in population, all they're going to do is destroy jobs at other locations and move them to that location. Now, we are not helpless to deal with this. There is no reason you have to be paying taxes that go to the wealthy. And by the way, when politicians tell you, you know, your taxes are too high and they want to get rid of them, especially those of you who are students, pay close attention to this. I was able to go to college, partly because of the GI Bill, because my dad was 100% disabled veteran of World War II. But primarily I could go to college because when I was your age, college was free. College was free. I never paid more than $300 in fees for a year. I still had to buy textbooks. They also had a policy back then, by the way, that every textbook every professor assigned, at least in California where I lived, had to be in the public, in the school library. And you could go there and read it if you couldn't afford to buy the book. Any of you got student loans? Anybody who doesn't have student loans these days? Okay. Banks, big commercial banks in the competitive market, on average, earn a 17% return on equity. And let me tell you what that means. You go open a savings account, you put $100 in it, and they pay you $3 interest, 3% at the end of the year. That's your return on equity. So big banks are earning 17%. Sallie Mae. What's Sallie Mae's return? Sallie Mae's loaning to students, people who are only speculatively able to pay their money back. I'll bet you were given papers that said your interest rate was 6.8% or something like that. Sallie Mae's profits, average, last 5 years, 51%. Three times the profit margin of commercial banks. Three times. That's not a market profit. That occurs because government has set rules. And the principal rule is this. You graduate from college, you better pay your loan back. It doesn't matter if you graduate from college and go into a field where suddenly there are no jobs for a couple of years. You graduate from college and you're doing everything right, and you walk down the street and some bandit comes out of a liquor store and the cops shoot at the bandit, and you, a half a mile away, get hit in the back, and you're out of work for a year. Tough luck. You will now be hit with penalties, and they'll jack your interest rate up to 29% interest. And Congress says there are only three ways you can get out of that loan. You know, banks write off loans all the time. Somebody can't pay, they decide they can't collect, they write it off. That's part of the lending business. The only way you can get out of your loan is you pay it back, you persuade them that you are 100% totally and permanently disabled, and even if the Social Security Administration says you are and workers' comp says you are, that doesn't mean the bank agrees you are, or you die broke. Those are your options. That's not a market. That's socialism. By the way, the man who's at the head of that company, let me tell you how wealthy a 51% annual return has made him. In Washington, D.C., where houses, little houses, sell for $1 million, he built himself a private 18-hole golf course with a small portion of his fortune. Well, we don't have to put up with this. And one of the ways I want to appeal to you to address this is I want you to go talk to your ministers. Because the number one evil denounced in the Bible, again and again and again, and evil is not my word, it's the word in the Bible. It's in the Old Testament, it's in the New Testament, is taking from those with less to give to those with more. It is the number one thing. And it says in the Bible, and I quote it in my book, that if you do this, your society will come to ruin. It is immoral. It is wrong. It is, indeed, I agree with the Old and New Testament, it is evil. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans in 2006 was the same as it was in the year 1980. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans peaked in 1973. Now, by the measure used in the current edition of my book, the average income has fallen 74%. Somebody's criticized the data that I used, and so I've used a more conservative inflation adjuster. Okay, instead of $74 a week less on average than 1973, the bottom 90% now get by on $11 a week less. It's still less. At the top, incomes have gone through the roof. The top 10% of Americans, the top 1%, and fractions of the top 1% have their largest share of national income in history, even greater than 1928 and 1929. And to give you an idea of how much they've gone up, remember, income's flat, bottom 90% on average. The top 1/100 of 1%, now that's a very tiny group of Americans, that's 30,000 people. If they all showed up at Yankee Stadium one day, half the seats would be empty. That's how small that group is. If they all went to Charleston, it would mean that 40% of the people in that city were gone for the day. Small number of men, women, and children. Their average income has gone from about $4 million a year in 1980, remember these are inflation-adjusted dollars, $4 million a year to $27 million a year. Last year in 2007, at least three Americans earned $3 billion of annual income. And their tax rate on that income is 15%. If you're a school teacher, you're probably in the 25% income tax bracket, and your marginal tax rate is over 40%. It's 25% to the federal government for income taxes. It's 15% to the federal government for Social Security. Half's paid by your employer, but that's just wages you're not getting. That brings you to 40 plus, because it's a fraction above that. And then you have a little unemployment tax on top of that you still may owe, and you're going to pay state taxes. Your marginal tax rate on the next dollar of income is 40%. Warren Buffett's is 15. There's a reason that rich people are charged high taxes. It's a moral principle. It is the most conservative principle in Western civilization. And the reason I say it's the most conservative principle in Western civilization is that it has survived for 2,500 years. It is this. In ancient Athens, which was the height of human achievement 2,500 years ago, they had art, they had theater, they had public sporting events, they had beautiful buildings, they had a flat tax. Every single person in Athens had to pay the same tax. And if you didn't pay the tax, they led you out to the city gates and sent you away, which was, in effect, for many people, a death sentence. For 80% of Athenians, this tax was a terrible burden. And getting to pay that tax led to all sorts of social problems you can imagine. People stealing people, killing, committing crimes, doing all sorts of bad things so they wouldn't be thrown out. The Athenians chewed on this issue for 200 years. It took a long time to figure problems out back then because they were just starting to think about them. And they finally had an insight. There is no wealth without civilization. You live in the jungle. You're a tiger. You can't get wealthy. Some thug can just come along and take everything from you. There's no civil court system to protect your property. There's no enhancement of the human mind so that there's some reason for people to make goods and trade them so that you can make money. It's civilization that makes it possible to become wealthy. Therefore, the moral principle was, the greater the wealth you have managed to attain for yourself, the greater your moral obligation to maintain the society that made that possible for you. and to help perpetuate that society so others can have that opportunity as we go into the future. And you know what happened when the Athenians figured that out? They invented something else. Democracy. Progressive tax systems are the hallmark of every free democratic peoples in the world. And we're violating the principle, the Athenian principle. Every classic worldly philosopher supports this. Adam Smith wrote in favor of progressive taxation. Adam Smith, the guy who figured out capitalism, before Karl Marx was a gleam in his father's eye. David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, James Mill, his father, John Locke, a man who never saw a tax he liked, George W. Bush, all believe in progressive taxation. Every one of them. And yet we don't have progressive taxation anymore. You'll hear people say, well, you know, the rich pay 38% of the income taxes. Well, they do. But when you look at all federal taxes, they make more than almost 23% of the income, and they pay 25% of the taxes. Hardly any difference at all. Because there are lots of taxes besides income taxes. Now, what do you do about this? Well, first of all, there's a moral issue. Taxes are about morals. They're about how we distribute the burden of society. If we're taxing the poor, the middle class, to give to the rich, you ought to be asking your minister about that. You ought to be talking about it to your friends at the PTA meeting, on the steps of church, at the softball game that your kids are in or your grandchildren are in, at the hair salon where your hair's getting cut, on those rare occasions when politicians deign to let you ask them questions. You ought to show up and ask them. And by the way, write your question down in advance. Rehearse what you want to ask. Make sure it's a question, not a statement. And get some friends to come. Because when the congressman says, well, I don't know about that, or tries to dodge it, have somebody else in them get up and say, wait a minute. I want an answer to that question. And if four or five or six people get up, and this happens repeatedly, trust me, the politicians will pay attention. Because if there's one thing that's always been true about politicians, they get up every morning, they wet a finger, and they hold it up to say which way the wind is blowing. And if they start detecting the wind's blowing in another direction, they're going to change their behavior. Now, this is not a simple problem. This is not going to get solved. This redistribution, this socialist redistribution scheme to the rich is not going to get solved tomorrow. It is not going to get solved in the November election. It's not going to get solved for a long time. It has taken us decades to sink into this situation. But we can solve this problem. We have a constitution that enshrined slavery. We got rid of it. 600,000 people had to die in the battlefield, 38,000 of them black Americans, and we haven't finished cleaning up the mess that it left behind. But you know what? We got rid of it. In 1848, the first ever meeting occurred up near where I live. I live in Rochester, New York, of women to talk about women's rights. And they wanted women to have the right to vote. Well, it took more than 70 years, but somehow women talked then into giving them the right to vote. You can go back and read literature from the late 1800s, and I can show you moral treatises on why it's proper that children should work in factories and should work long hours. Because there's no evil that you won't find people who, if paid to do it, won't come up with arguments to support. Well, we got child labor laws. We got clean food laws. We got antitrust laws. We can solve this problem. It will not happen overnight. And here's the question you need to ask yourself. Do you want to go home and focus on who's the next American Idol? Or do you want to hasten the day when your descendants are going to sit down in a high school classroom and pick up a history book with a chapter whose opening words are these? The United States of America was. Thank you. So, questions. And do ask questions, not statements. Who's got a question? Oh, come on. Okay. That's a question people ask me all the time, and here's my answer to that. Okay. I'm not God. I'm not King George. I'm a journalist. My job is that I have spent years of my life. Most journalists, you know, do a very good job of telling you the official version of events. An airplane fell out of the sky. The president gave a speech and said this. Somewhere a mailman bit a dog, because there's always a little humor in the news. And they practice what I call he said journalism. They accurately quote what people said and often have no idea what they're writing about. I've spent 13 years digging into the most boring, complicated government records to find this stuff. That's my role in this, to tell you about it and to write books that through the lives of people explain to you how it works. I'm not a political officer. I'm not an organizer. I'm not running for office. And solutions in a democracy have to come from the people. People, if they debate and discuss these issues, will come to wise choices. And there may be very different choices than I would imagine, but that's not my role in this. I know that a lot of people aren't happy with that, and I can tell you're not.
I have a problem with that, though. You're a rational man.
Yep. Well, okay, so now you got me to the point. Here's what I'll say on the principle. People ask me, what's the right tax rate for people? I don't know what the right tax rate is, but I know what the principles are. The principles are the greater your economic gain, the greater the share of your gain you should be putting back to the government so that other people have opportunity. It is inappropriate, at a minimum, evil, according to the religious text, to take from those with less to give to those with more. Let's stop that. How do you stop that? You tell politicians, you tax me to give money to Donald Trump, I organize my community, and we're going to vote you out of office and put in somebody who will do something different. On the level of principle, I think the answers to that are simple. You know, let's have government do the appropriate things government does. Let's not have government pick the winners and losers in the economy, and you do that by electing people to office who are going to represent those kinds of ideas. But that's about the end of where I go on that. I want to stimulate debate and discussion. That's why I wrote these books. I want people talking and thinking because that's what a democracy requires. If you want to be free, you can't outsource running the government to the political donor class or you get what we have. And you can't outsource being a citizen. You've got to do it yourself. So, sorry if that's not satisfactory. Professor. Okay, give me the second one.
Okay. And the second one is it your sense that the people who are most in support of the fair tax know that in supporting it, they have violated the principle of the
okay. Do you all know, let me explain to you what the fair tax is, and I want to explain to you a related tax, the flat tax. And let me do the flat tax and get it out of the way, okay, because people hear these two terms all the time. Back in 1972, George McGovern was running for president of the United States, very sad, sorry campaign for president, and one day he announced that he was going to send every American every April a check for $1,000. And I think it would be fair to say that those were old enough to remember this that we all laughed. Yeah, where's he going to get the $1,000 from us and then give it back? What he was really trying to do was get us onto a consumption tax, and that's what the fair tax is. Instead of taxing incomes, we would tax what you consume, what you purchase. And you need the $1,000 or some amount because otherwise the poor would be treated unfairly because the poor consume all of their incomes and have no ability to save. Whereas if you made $100 million a year, unless you're a gambling fool, you're going to consume a very small part of your income and you're going to save and invest the rest of it. Well, an economist named Robert Hall, a libertarian who is now the guy who chairs the committee that when they announce we're in a recession or the recession is over, that's the guy. Very eminent economist who was then a graduate student or a young professor. Understood what McGovern wanted to do, even if the newspaper reporters and the TV reporters didn't. And on the proverbial rainy day, and I tell this story in Perfectly Legal, he sat down with a pad of paper and a pencil and said, is there a way to do what this, to have a consumption tax, but stick with the income tax model because everybody knows it? And he came up with a way to do it. And what he did was he said, you get taxed on all your wages, and the interest you pay on your home mortgage, or if you're a business, no deduction. The interest you collect from the bank, no tax. Dividends, no tax. Capital gain, you buy a stock for this price, sell it for a higher price. You buy an oil painting at this price, sell it at a higher price, no tax. The business entity itself, ExxonMobil, Sam's department store, they'll pay a tax, but the money will flow to the owner after that with no tax. And having solved this intellectual problem, Bob put it away. And by the way, he intended it to have multiple tax rates. He ran into somebody one day, explained to them what it was. He said, they said, we should do a book about it, and he got talked into proposing a single tax rate. I call that tax the Steve Forbes never has to pay taxes again law. And you know who its chief proponent is in the United States? Steve Forbes. Because Steve Forbes would just live off his capital income and never pay taxes. Well, there's another idea that's come along. The fair tax. The fair tax is essentially a national retail sales tax. You pay sales taxes all the time, right? You go to the store, you pay a dollar. I just paid a dollar for two newspapers, and it was 6 cents more for the sales tax. Only the fair tax would apply it to everybody. And, as with George McGovern's proposal in 1972, there'd be a check back to people so that the poor were not unfairly burdened by this. The fair tax advocates say the tax rate would be 23%. So assuming they're correct, here in West Virginia, your tax rate would be 29% every time you bought something. Want to buy a dollar candy bar? It's $1.29. Critics of this plan contend that the numbers are low, that the real tax rate would be 33, so you'd pay $1.39. But I'll accept, for the sake of argument, that it'll only turn out to be 23 cents. The tax would be paid on every retail purchase. So when the government goes and buys these chairs, the government would pay the tax. And where'd the government get its money? Every purchase would be covered. And the argument is that it would be fair because there wouldn't be loopholes and favors, of which our tax code is full of them. Well, here are the problems with the tax. First of all, anybody who has saved money in the tax system after tax would be taxed again. You made $100, you paid the tax, you put $60 into a savings account, they change to the fair tax, you go buy something, you got to pay tax again. You got to have an adjustment for it. It's not fair. And anybody with savings may well go out just before the tax changes from income tax to the fair tax, the transition. And if they're smart, they're going to go buy 5 years of things that, you know, stay on your shelf, like tuna fish and new furniture and a car. And then when the new tax takes place, what's going to happen? Well, you know how your better-off neighbors are always bragging, oh, yeah, we get a new car every 2 years. Look at the new Caddy. People are going to start saying, yeah, we got 812,000 miles on the Toyota, and she's still running, and we're working for 100 because we don't want to pay the tax again. Now, by the way, if you're a radical environmentalist, the fair tax is the best thing you can imagine. People are not going to go just throw their socks away. They're going to go back to darning socks. How many people in here have ever darned a sock? Couple of you. You don't know what I'm talking about, do you? Or a darning egg. You go look it up, okay? People are going to reduce their consumption to avoid that tax. But here's the real problem about it. What do people do today who want to buy drugs? Do they just walk into a store and say, hey, sell me some cocaine or some methamphetamine or some grass? They furtively slip into a building, take a little money out of their pocket, they get back a little package, and they walk out the door, right? Well, what do you think is going to happen to people who want to buy diamond rings and fur coats and other little luxuries? They're going to go to the black market so they don't have to pay the tax. And by the way, the sales tax, anybody who's involved in sales tax business, and I've interviewed tax authorities about this all across the country, auditors, collectors, administrators, it's full of holes. You think every little yard sale, they're there collecting the tax? Well, that's going to lead to something else. The government's going to say, you know that stuff you've been using to buy goods with? You reach in your wallet, you pull it out, and you go, oh, cash. Well, the government's going to say, I'm sorry, we can't have cash anymore. We're going to have an electronic record of every purchase. Every purchase will have to be done with an electronic card of some kind so that we have a record of it. I'm sorry, the government's going to have a record of every single thing you do. Would you like your parents to have a record of every purchase you've ever made? Would you like your spouse to have a record of every purchase you've ever made? Like to explain some of them? Would you like your children or your business competitor to be able to get a copy of a record of every purchase you've ever made? There are real serious problems with changing it. And by the way, nobody in the world uses this system. Nobody. Now, there is a related system called the value-added tax. Company mines iron ore out of the ground. When they sell it, there's a price for the value they added, and they pass it on to the guy who smelts and refines the ore. The refining company then sells it to the steel company. They pay a price. The steel company sells it to the rolling company. They pay a price. They sell it to General Motors to build a car. They pass the tax on to them. And you come buy the car, and General Motors collects. That's a self-reinforcing tax. And it works. And here's the most important thing. Who's the author of the book, The Fair Tax? Is it an eminent authority on government finance? Is it a respected economist, whatever his politics are, like Robert Hall? Is it a former government official or tax administrator? A radio talk show host. You know, whatever, however much you may enjoy listening to Keith Olbermann or Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly or Al Franken before he decided to become a politician, you really want those people designing your tax system? That's the real fundamental problem with it is, I don't believe it'll work. And I acknowledge that there are, in fact, respected people. Larry Kotlikoff, who I have enormous respect for, who's an economist at MIT, who is a big fan of it and a paid consultant for the project, he says it'll work. But I will tell you that the vast majority of leading people in this field, and I know them all, they just think this is nonsense. So, who's next? I'll give a shorter answer this time. Sir. I hope I get a woman to ask a question before we go tonight, but go ahead. Well, that's why I said, just for the sake of argument, I'll accept that their claim. I don't believe it. I think the numbers show it doesn't work, but even if you accept their argument, 23% tax is enough to deter a lot of people from buying something. And just digressing one of the point, one of the contentions made by the people who support the fair tax is that your wages, you'll have more money to spend? No, economic theory is very clear on that. If an income tax is built into the wages they pay you, that is, for your employer to give you $100, they really have to pay you, say, $125 so that you net $100, then your wages will fall. They have to. There's no free lunch. Okay, I'm sorry. So what was your question? Yeah, there are also serious constitutional questions. They're also with the income tax. It has all taxes impose problems. They're just necessary. So, anybody else? Come on, students. You're here. What are you studying? Economics, homemaking, business, nursing. Well, so what do you want to know? You came here tonight for something. Come on, anybody else got a question?
David.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We've got a question out of the chat room here.
Okay.
Going back to what you were saying early on about the manipulation of the energy markets and Enron and all of that, how does that play into what we're seeing happening in the oil market now with what some have argued are incredibly inflated speculation-based prices?
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of people who believe the reason oil costs so much is speculators, and it's easy to blame speculators and on oil prices. But there's actually a very simple explanation for why oil costs so much. And all you have to do is just imagine for a moment that you're a Saudi or a Kuwaiti prince or princess. Okay? Stop being an American. And, you know, a daddy has his own 747 for the horses. If you doubt that, just go over at horse raising season time to Louisville and look what's at the airport or go down to Austin in the summer. And you'll see all these two kinds of jumbo jets. The personal jumbo jets of these folks, and then the jumbo jets for their horses. Well, you're just a prince or princess. You'd like to buy your first jet. And so you go to Airbus and say, I'd like my own personal A320, and I want it, you know, blinged out this way. And they go, okay, well, oil's priced in American dollars. You have American dollars. You know, the American dollar's been losing value. And you know, if you'd come to us back in 2000, we would have charged you $20 million for the plane you want, or if it's an A320, probably $120 million. But the dollar's not worth as much anymore to us Europeans, so we need not $120 million, but $240 million. What's going on is the weak dollar. We have sold so much of our country overseas. Warren Buffett estimates 2% a year of our wealth we're selling overseas, that the value of the dollar is falling. If you were going on vacation to Europe, I'm going to Europe to do research this summer twice, and it's unbelievable how expensive it's going to be because the dollar is cheaper. Back in 2000, the ratio was $1.40 to 1. It's now 80 cents. That's an enormous drop. That's the single biggest reason that these prices have gone up. The price of recovering oil at the wellhead, that hasn't gone up significantly. That hasn't changed. There's also growing demand that is affecting prices, and there's a limited amount of refining capacity. But the biggest single driver is the weak dollar, the cheap dollar. And that's been the government's policy since the new administration came in. So, sir, come on, woman. Some woman in here. Think of a question. Go ahead. Sure. Good statement. That's a good point. What I'm trying to get across, and the key point, and I probably stepped all over my foot in saying it to the person who asked the question, was what I try to do is talk about the principles of things. And once you understand the principles of things, people will figure out how to do it. I don't think any answer I would come up with would be nearly as good as what collectively as a society would come up with. There are bright people who I meet all the time who tell me things I had no idea, things I've studied deeply for years. And I go, wow. You know, and every once in a while I get real lucky. I was talking to a business professor at the University of Michigan this week, and I said something to him, and he said, wow, that's a great insight. You know, but you miss lots of things. No one individual can see everything. What I'm trying to do is tell people fundamentally, here's what's been done to you by the system. Here is how they did it to you. Now you go decide what you want to do about it, and if you want to do something about it. And, you know, it's entirely possible that some people will say, I want more of this. I'm in favor of this. I want to organize people to have more corporate socialism. Okay, it's free society. If you win, you win. People who want to get write me all the time when I was at the New York Times, and they would say, how do we change the tax laws? And I would write back and always say the same thing, elect another Congress. A surprising number of people would say, well, what do we do about the IRS? And I go, they're just the tax police. Congress sets the rules. Go read the Constitution. My point is I'm trying to give people information. They can decide what you want to do with it. You can decide, I don't want to listen to this guy. He's an idiot. You can decide, I want to learn more about it. You can decide, I'm going to devote my whole life to stopping subsidies to Cabela's. You know, that's not my part of the game. If I were in the solutions business, I suspect I'd have a lot more money. Solutions pays better. I'm in the diagnosis business. I've always noticed that the surgeons get paid more, you know, than the GPs who diagnose the problem. So, anybody else? Okay, well, I'm going to be outside if you want to chat with you one-on-one. I'm going to sign books. I hope a number of you get my books. I have a website, freelunchthebook.com. Unlike most journalists, I don't hide from people. I put my phone numbers and my email address on the Internet, and, you know, the occasional screwball case I get, I speak nicely to people and say goodbye to them. I am working on another book that will be out hopefully in about 2 years called The Fine Print, which is about all of the things you think the government protects you with, like your pension or your insurance policy, that don't anymore because of what's been done to those laws by lobbyists. So thank you all very much for turning out tonight.
Well, that doesn't fire you up to learn more. I don't know what possibly will. So it's about half past the 8 o'clock hour here on the East Coast, and we would ordinarily have about 30 minutes of programming left tonight, but it's time to break things down and see if we can't get back to the ranch in time for maybe, yes, Ferg. Oh, I'm sorry, my co-host, Ferg, I think he's going to not speak to me if I don't open his microphone. All right, boy, there you are.
This was a very good conversation tonight.
I thought it was. Now there you are. You'll a couple more years, you'll be in high school. Does this make you want to study this kind of thing and tell others about it?
Yes, because as his speech said, how he went through all the boring stuff, but he found actually very good dirt on the government and what makes you think what they're doing to help you, but they're cheating you. Mm-hmm. I think that if I did that,
do you understand that working people are getting cheated on behalf of a specific group of people, that is the very richest of the rich?
Yes, I do.
How does that make you feel?
I think it makes me feel a little angry because that could be the children one day, us, the children today are going to be tomorrow's mayor of
Podunk.
Yeah. And
well, I got news for you. You're getting ripped off already, okay? Because what these people are doing to you via government policy is taking away your future from you. Now, what are you going to do when you get back to school in the fall? You going to tell other people what you've learned, or are you just going to sit on your hands?
I'm going to tell my teachers and the students what I've learned about during my past summer.
Okay, well, very good. Ferg, thank you very much for joining us. And with that, I think we're going to knock it off for the evening. I tell you what, I'm going to shut the stream down here, Agnes. How about playing us some closing music? Thanks, everybody. Thanks to our friends at Seneca 2 who initially brought David K. Johnston here. Thanks very much to Dr. Bill O'Brien for allowing this beautiful facility to be used. Thank you to you, and thanks to the folks who showed up to learn this. Maybe they'll go and do something with it now that they've heard the facts on the ground. Thanks to our good friends at Cold River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. The hardest working, bravest people I know. So, you know, we wouldn't without their help, we wouldn't be sitting here tonight. So, Agnes, I'm going to break the stream, and if you don't mind, start the stream up and play us the out music, if you please. And always, 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 RMR, Gina. It's all for you.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
If you or someone close to you has a hearing loss, here is some great news. Thousands of Open Caption videos are yours to borrow, and it's all free. Open Caption videos make it possible for the hearing impaired to understand television. The Caption Media Program offers classic Hollywood movies, special interest, and educational videos. Visit us online at cfv.org or call 1-800-237-6213. You can register to be a user and make your selections from our online or printed catalog. It's just that easy, and we'll even pay for the postage. Open Caption videos are perfect for the classroom, your home, or even the workplace. The nonprofit Caption Media Program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. Tell a family member or a friend about the Caption Media Program today. Bookmark cfv.org for free loan Open Caption videos or call 1-800-237-6213.
Please stay with us because up next will be our favorite host, Peter Godbold, live, and he has a guest tonight, Ariel Techna. I hope you'll stay with us and enjoy the programming.
Trying.
there's one place on the web you can go that's so topical, you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Wide Wally and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. So stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com. A place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. Your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
This is the story about a group of kids who volunteered.
We fixed stuff. Did some art projects with the kids.
Cleaned up the park.
We worked in the woods.
I just wanted to do something.
We fixed up this house.
Did something for the planet.
Hey, that was all I needed. And you know what? It was great.
It was a blast.
At first, they didn't know each other.
I didn't know anyone.
Well, that didn't last long.
This guy is really funny.
Me?
These are my new friends. These are really good new friends.
Are you into it?
Are You Into It is a volunteer program for kids like you who care. If you want to make a difference in your community and make friends, call 4-H toll-free at 1-888-77-YOUTH or check out our website at www.areyouintoit.com.
This definitely made a difference.
I feel like I could do everything.
Yeah!
A public service message brought to you by 4-H, the Cooperative Extension System, and the Ad Council.
Each flash of lightning is dangerous, even the first. So head to safety before that first flash. Remember, you are in danger from a lightning strike if you can hear thunder. Learn more about lightning safety at www.lightningsafety.noaa.gov. Lightning kills. Play it safe. This message is brought to you by the Iowa High School Athletic Association and your local National Weather Service office.
Life was so wonderful, a miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they'd be singing so happily, oh, joyfully. Oh, they believe watching me. But then they sent me away, teach me how to be. Cynical.
Everyone. one's got a theory about the bitter one. They're saying, mama never loved her much, and daddy never keeps in touch. That's why she shies away from human affection. But somewhere in a private place, she packs back for outer space. And now she's waiting for the right kind of pilot to come.
Thank you for being with Bob tonight and his live remote from the wonderful Concord College in Beckley, West Virginia. And I hope that you'll stay tuned for Peter Godbold and Strictly Confidential. And now, have a good evening.
That's 25.